So this talk will be mostly focused on the experimental side and trying to explain you in detail the sensors technology. So it might be also a good opportunity if you can think of other applications for these sensors that we have recently. The experiment that we had as a goal for developing these technologies was Sensei. That is an experiment looking for light dark matter. And so the objective here that we had is to try to detect dark matter through the dark matter electron scattering interactions or absorption, and then measure the ion use in our detector. For this purpose, we started with a technology that is very well known, that is the CCD technology. So this is nice because we have tens of years of R&D that have been going into this direction. So we can use CCDs, we know a lot about them, and we'll be exploding a lot of the R&D that has been already done with this detector. So the idea in here is to look for the dark matter particle that interacts with the electrons in the crystal lattice of the silicon of the CCD itself. That is very important. So we are using the CCD as the target itself, not to detect the light produced in another media, but just as a target. We will be looking for interactions that happen in the crystal lattice, the silicon, and that produces ionization. So they promote one or more electrons into the conduction band. These interactions, because they are low energy, they are all point-like, and they all happen within the scale much smaller than 1 pixel. Okay. Yep.
Dark matter particles is assumed to be neutral, right? It's not charged.
Well, you can have
some sort of collision.
Yeah. So depending on the model that you use for dark matters, your sensitivity will be different. But yeah. So this is assuming that the dark matter can interact with electrons through some mediator that can be the dark photon.
But I'm not knocking the nucleus around. Or
exactly. Yeah.
You might also interact with the nucleus, but the interaction is just too small to observe.
Yeah. When it's really light. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So in this case, we are able to explore much lower dark matter candidates because the electrons are lighter, and just by kinematic reasons, we can see that. So what was the story behind this thing? So this started as a small collaboration that was an LDRD, that is laboratory directed research and development. This was funded by Fermilab in 2015 with the objective of developing a new detector, a new generation of detectors that could get to the silicon, an energy threshold that was the silicon band gap, that is around 1.1 eV. So this project we developed the Skipper CCD technology that, although was proposed about 30 years ago, it never worked until we made it work with this project. So the CCDs that we use, we are producing collaboration with Berkeley Lab, and this is the Microsystems Lab, and our interaction is mostly with Steve Holland there. So in 2017, we successfully completed all the goals that we have established for this proposal. So we built the first working detector for the first time in 30 years that uses this Skipper CCD technology that we'll be explaining a little bit about. And then we validated this technology for dark matter and neutrino experiments, in which we look for electron recoil or nuclear recoils in the case of neutrino experiments. So after the successful completion of the LDRD program, we started the Sensei collaboration. That's a collaboration that has many institutions. It's an international collaboration. And we are fully funded by the Heisen-Simons Foundation and also by Fermilab, that provides all the labor and a lot of support from Fermilab. So now let me spend some minutes explaining how a CCD works and what is actually what we've done to improve them. So this is a cartoon of a CCD that we are looking at this from the top. So all these structures are printed into a silicon slab, okay? And what you have here is a 3 pixels by 3 pixels CCD. And these structures here that are blue are called the channel stops. These are permanent potential barriers that are produced by implanting impurities on the silicon. So what you have is that if you have ionization that is produced in this region, it can drift freely in this direction, but it cannot drift in this direction because you have this permanent potential barrier. And you cannot turn that off. That is always there. But you know that CCDs are pixelated detectors, so not strip detectors. So how we do generate the pixels? We do that by using a very neat trick. That is, we have these other structures that are the parallel clocks. P1, P2, P3, that we can control the potential that we apply to those things independently, okay? So if, let's say that we put P1 and P3 at a high level and P2 at a low level, then we generate a potential well that is located in this location, this location, this location. So by doing that, if we have any ionization produced in this area, the electrons will drift and be collected into this potential well. And they will sit there until you decide to read out. Because you might have noticed that none of these pixels actually have any way of reading them out by themselves. So we need to do something to actually measure how much charge was produced and is collected there. And
how deep is the potential?
It's a few volts. Yeah.
And the holes have gone to the other side of the same.
Yeah, I'm a little bit lying here. What we are collecting is the holes, not the electrons, but it's essentially the same physics.
So,
yeah.
This is what's confused me about this. So how mm-hmm. how do you prevent recombination?
So if you look at this from the, I mean, as a cross section, you apply a voltage across the CCD, and that separates the electrons and the holes, and the amount of recombination is essentially zero.
Okay.
It's a little capacitor, right?
Yeah, it's a little capacitor.
Voltage is. Mm-hmm. Sorry, can you explain again how you prevent recombination? You put a voltage across. Which direction is the voltage?
So, I mean, we are looking at this from the top. So now, if you look at the CCD from the side, okay? So you will have your pixels up here, okay? And you have an electric field that is applied in this direction. So when you have an interaction, you will separate by drifting the electron and the hole pairs, okay?
Cool, thanks.
You just need to get it out of the surface before you combine this.
Okay, so now we have our electrons sitting in this potential well, and then we decide to read out. So what we do is the following. Because we can change these voltages at will, what we can do is to modify them. So let's say that now we had, at the beginning in the collecting state, we were on state one. Then we decide to read out after hours, days, or whatever. And then what we have is that we lower the P1, keeping the other one low, then we rise P2, then we have shift the charge by one third of a pixel. But if we do this in seven steps, we have that our charge has moved from this pixel to this pixel. Okay? And all the charge that was sitting on this column is moved to this one, and the charge that was sitting on the last column is moved into this other structure that is also part of the same silicon piece, that it's called the serial register. This is exactly the same silicon as the other. The only difference is that now we don't have these permanent potential barriers that are the channel stops, so the charge can move freely in this direction. And also that we have these other sets of independent clocks that we can control in the same way as this and generate our potential wells here, 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 and then move the charge down. So after this step, we have this charge moved into this one, this column moved into this one, we have our charge sitting there, and now we are shifting the charge into this other structure that is called the sense node, that is the only thing that is actually instrumented and connected to a readout electronics. Yep.
Sorry, so just to clarify, so when you're the drifting of the electrons, so you're not trying to do like what CDMS does, where you rip them apart and then they shed photons on their way out? It's
No.
Slow.
Yes, we don't have any amplification here.
Yeah.
We are just, I mean, this process of moving the electrons from one column to the next one is super slow, and the fields involved are very small.
So the point is you get spectral information just by the number of electrons and not the fact that they had some extra kinetic energy on the way out. Okay.
Yeah. So you measure the charge that was deposited in each of these pixels by measuring the voltage change in this structure here that is the sense node, that is essentially a capacitor connected to a voltmeter. Okay. So the beauty of this design is that, in principle, you can have an arbitrarily large detector, but the capacitance of your readout stage is just set by the sense node, which can be very, very small. In our case, that is 0.05 picofarads, and that translates into 3 microvolts per each electron that we place into this capacitor. Okay?
And it takes, let's see, 7 steps to move it one this way.
Mm-hmm.
And then 7 more
yep.
move down the sense node, and then you do that 9 times.
In this case, yes. With a real CCD, we do that millions of times. But yeah.
There's only one readout amplifier, no matter how many pixels you've got up there.
I mean, that's the basic design. In principle, you can split this thing and have many smaller sections of serial register and have many readout stage. That increases the amount of channel, of course, but I mean, allows you to read out faster.
How well can you measure the voltage?
That's what, that's the trick. That's what I'm going to talk about now. So,
what is the time scale for each jump?
So, the time scale for each, I mean, it depends, but it is quite fast. So, you can do this in the order microsecond. Well, depending on the things, on how you operate these things, it will be microsecond or millisecond scale. But that's the range, roughly. There are reasons why you would like to do this slowly, I mean, more slowly or faster, depending on what's your application. But you can change that by software.
Why would you want to do it slowly?
Sometimes, if you do the shift too quickly, you have some probability of producing spurious charge by just, I mean, having a high gradient in this potential well. So sometimes you want to vary this thing slowly, so you don't have that.
So during the readout phase, it seems like you'd end up with information about how far away the electrons were, but not really an XY coordinate. Is that correct?
No, you do get the XY coordinate because you know how many shifts you did in this direction, and you know how many shifts you did in this direction. So you reconstruct the XY origin of the charge perfectly. Okay.
So how are you creating the potential wells? Is it just you're distorting the band structure of the...
No. So these are kind of conductive structures that you print on top of the CCD.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So after you drift the electrons towards the surface of the CCD, they move towards, I mean, they move in what it's called a buried channel. So you have another minimum that is located very close to the surface of the CCD.
Uh-huh.
And then you have these other structures that provide a voltage that, I mean, those potential wells you generate and at this depth on the CCD.
So is there any interesting effect that happens at the surface that's like particular to the band structure of silicon, or do you think this would just work with a generic semiconductor?
In principle, there is no, order one, there is no effect there. In principle, because you are printing stuff on top, you might have a higher chance of dislocations or defects on the silicon lattice. But yeah, that's the only thing that I can think of. Okay, so but this is what it's a standard CCD readout. So we know how to do this for many, many years. Okay?
Well, so thank you for educating us.
Yeah. and this here is, so now if I zoom in into this region, the readout region, okay, what you have here is these H things here are these serial register clocks, okay? And then we have another structure that I did not show here that it's called the summing well. It's again, another potential well that you can generate and change at will. And you have this output gate that it's a potential well barrier that you can also generate there. And this is the sense node that you can connect to a reference voltage to drain all the charge that was sitting there. Then you disconnect that. That will float because it's completely isolated. And the voltage level will be completely set by the fields around it. So you measure that. That is your pedestal. Then what you do is you move up the summing well, move the charge into this sense node, measure again the voltage, and that's your signal. Okay, so this it's a very simple procedure, and it's known as the correlated double sampling. Okay, and what you can see from here is that the longer you integrate, in principle, the better estimator that you get for the charge. There are limits there that I will discuss, but in principle, this looks very nice. You can, in principle, reduce the noise as much as you want by, yeah.
Sorry, so this seems like the magic source, right? So I just want to make sure I understand. This SW well, so you're saying in the gathering stage, I'm gathering my electrons, and then I drain it somehow and measure the potential difference, but I thought I control SW. So I raise SW to get rid of the charge inside.
Yes.
Then how do I get the potential difference before and after to measure my signal?
So, I mean, what...
Oh,
what,
you measure the charge of the sensor, you measure the voltage on
yes.
the sensor, and then you
Yeah, so you measure the charge two times. One after you isolate your sense node, and it's, but it's empty, and one after you move the charge into this thing. And so, I mean, you would measure after this thing has bounced all the way down.
Okay, all right.
Okay. So.
And you measure it by measuring the current going to ground or.
Yeah, so the way that, I mean, the detailed way that we read the voltage in here is that, yeah, we have a transistor that, I mean, depending on the voltage of the input, it produces a current, and we charge another transistor, you know those. Okay. So now, this correlated double sampling technique, it's very nice because, in principle, you can completely get rid of the high frequency noise just by integrating longer, but the limitation is that if you have a low frequency noise that is, I mean, longer or the order of this frequency, then you will be integrating that noise in, okay? And the problem with that is that all the transistors that we know how to build, absolutely everything that we have produced, has what it's called the 1 over F noise, that is an increase in the noise when you go to lower frequencies. And that is unavoidable as far as we know. Okay, so the problem is that if you keep increasing your integration window, you will start integrating this exponentially growing noise at low frequencies, and that is the limitation of the current technology. So that is why you cannot increase the integration time as much as you want, because you hit that barrier. Okay, and this is kind of state-of-the-art CCD technology. This is real data. This is taken with a real CCD, standard CCD. And what you have here is the distribution of the voltage, I mean the charge that you measure for empty pixels. So you take a dark photo, and then you see this histogram that is the distribution of the empty pixels. The RMS of these things is roughly 2 electrons, okay? And this is, for me, absolutely amazing how Gaussian this thing is, and it's not a simulation. So this is real data.
What's the y-axis?
The y-axis is the number of pixels that you have it per bin.
So the point is, like, you're actually, like, this is actually a central limit theorem thing. You're actually just counting something in, like...
Mm-hmm. Excuse me?
Like, why it's so Gaussian is, like, the underlying process is actually some sort of Poisson
yeah.
process, and you're actually just counting things. And
yeah. So, I mean, you are averaging these things over long periods of time. So if you think about each sub-period as an independent thing, central limit theorem,
yeah,
you get that. But it's amazing that it works. So this is essentially what sets the limit of the current CCD technology. And you can see that because you have millions of pixels, actually the threshold of this thing is in the order of tens of electrons. And that translates roughly into 50 eV of threshold. OK, so now what have we done? We have changed the readout stage, that is the Skipper CCD idea. We have kept everything else exactly the same. And this is extremely good because we don't need to demonstrate any new thing there. We know that all this collection region has been optimized and perfected for tens of years, so that is really good. We are just focusing on changing how we read out. And the idea is actually very simple. It was proposed in 1990, but it never really worked because of several problems. I mean, we can discuss that in detail, but now we have made this work. And the idea is that, imagine that you could take multiple non-destructive measurements that are independent and uncorrelated of the amount of charge that you have sitting in the sense node. If you could do that, you could take multiple measurements that you integrate for a short period of time, and then you would not be hit by the 1 over F noise, but after averaging many of these things, at the end you can defeat the 1 over F noise. And the way to do that is to modify the readout stage in a way that you can lower this output gate and move the charge back and forth and take this correlated double sampling many times. And this is what we had with a regular CCD, and this is pictographically what we get with a Skipper CCD, okay? So overall, the total integration time is the same in both cases, but in this case, because we are integrating in very short periods of time each sample, we are not hit by the 1 over F noise. And You could say, yeah, but if you have a noise that exactly matches this frequency, you will be hit by that. And the answer is yes. But the beauty is that you can decide the frequency that you use. So you have your system, you characterize it, and then you decide which frequency is the best, and you use that one.
So you just randomize the pulse times? And
you could do that, but I will show you that actually we don't need to do that. We already get perfectly independent, non-correlated samples with the simplest technique. Yeah.
And just again to be very, very basic, the readout in the top pedestal and then signal is just literally the amount of time that you're letting your system sort of equilibrate and give you a voltage reading.
Yep.
Like, it's literally just time.
Yep.
Sorry, can I just say a little more how you measure the charge non-destructively?
Yes, so this is the trick that we have. So remember that in the standard CCD, you had this output gate that was a permanent barrier that you could not move up and down, okay? So after you move, I know that this looks like very simple, but the idea is very simple, then the implementation gets complicated. But in a standard CCD, you have this potential barrier that is the output gate. So let me go back here. The output gate is a permanent potential barrier that you cannot move up and down. So after you moved up your charge into the sense node, the only way to take the next measurement is to actually drain the charge from here and measure the next pixel. But you are destroying the charge after you measure it. Okay? In the Skipper CCD, you have the ability to move the charge that was sitting in the sense node back again into a summing well and repeat the correlated double sampling process.
Let me, my question is even more elementary. Just when it's in the sense node, how do you measure that there are four electrons there without destroying the electrons?
So this is capacitively coupled with a amplifier. So you don't have any current going from this thing to the other thing. It's just a capacitor.
But there must be some amplitude for the electron to tunnel into the gate, and no amplifier is infinite inputting beams. It always has a finite resistance value.
No. So this is not connected directly to the amplifier.
No.
So it's capacitively connected.
But no capacitor then is completely arbitrarily low conductance.
Yeah. So there must be. So in principle, there must be some very, very small leakage current there, but we are not even able to measure that.
It's just zero.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's a question.
Mm-hmm. Scott asked my question. I always ask exactly that.
Oh, I see. So that capacitive coupling is the reason why your voltage reading goes as 1/√ the time oil, like that.
Yep.
Because you're reading
off. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, so how does the instrument look like? So this is a picture of our first prototype that we built at Fermilab using these Skipper CCDs that we are producing in collaboration with Berkeley. These are detectors that, because this was an LDRD, high risk, small amount of money, the production of this thing was done parasitically. That means that we didn't get to choose all the characteristics of the silicon and the production process that we had to use for this thing. So these things were produced together with some astronomical instruments, and that means that the silicon here was not the highest resistivity. Also, that they introduced anti-reflective coating for astronomical instruments that is radioactive. So for dark matter searches, it's not the best thing. But for demonstrating the readout technology, these things are perfectly fine. Okay, and in this case, we tested four different. So going back to your question before, we have four quadrants in this thing. So we have four amplifiers in the same chip. And each of these quadrants has a different design for the readout stage because we were doing R&D, so we got to characterize and learn a lot from changing the designs on these things. All the systems integration we did at Fermilab, we built the cold electronics, all the system that we have, and we modified Monsoon electronic that was developed for the dark energy camera in order to be able to read out our detectors. And most importantly, we learn how to operate these things because this thing has never existed before. So actually understanding how to operate them and what was the proper way to get the most from these things is what really took us a lot of effort. So for you to get an idea of how a CCD works as a particle detector, not just as an imager, in here I have a zoom in of real data that we took with this setup here. Okay, this was exposed to just environmental radiation, and there was an X-ray source inside this vessel. So what you can see here is all these small hits that are coming from X-ray hits. Okay, then these long tracks that are produced by cosmic muons, and then you have this sea of empty pixels. Okay. What is important is that we not only measured, I mean, it's not just a picture, but we measure the amount of charge that is sitting in each of these pixels here. So now if we take this sea of empty pixels and produce a histogram with the charge that we measure on those empty pixels, what we see is that, and this is where the magic happens, and you see that those empty pixels, yes, most of those have zero electrons in them, but some of those have one, some of those have two, and the RMS of this thing is 0.06 electrons. So essentially, you are more than 5 sigma away from confusing n or n plus 1 electrons here, so reducing the noise further doesn't buy you anything. You are already in the electron counting regime. So this is awesome. We have a detector with zero noise now.
How many times do you have to do this?
So in this case, we took 4,000 samples and averaged those. And that is, of course, that takes time. Because you take more samples, you take more time to read out. And I will discuss that in detail. So for just to give you a graphical idea of how this compares to existing CCD technology, this is also real data. What you have here is just a zoom in on a CCD. This was read using standard CCD mode. The noise here was around 3.5 electrons. And there is one electron sitting there. Of course, you cannot see it. And this is the distribution of the whole image. This is the pixel distribution. You get this super wide Gaussian. You can absolutely not measure anything there. But now, after doing the skipper processing, you get absolutely no doubt that there is an electron sitting there, and these are the electron peaks that you have for 0, 1, 2, 3, so on. Yep.
Sorry, this looks totally freaking amazing, but just very, very concretely, the y-axis,
yep.
Is that the number of pixels with that many electrons?
Yep.
So the yellow is an expected one electron pixel. It's not a noise one electron. These are not noise one electron pixels.
No, this is an actual electron sitting in the well.
Right, but is that a...
He's asking where the electron came from.
Oh.
Yeah, is it noise?
No. You shine light, very dim light, and just an optic photon will produce one electron, and that's what you see.
Sorry, so where are the pixels that have two?
Yeah.
So this is just a zoom in a region of the image. So this, histogram is for the whole image.
Okay. I see. So the real information is that rather than having a soup over there, you have, like, whatever image you have, the truth level information will give you some charge distribution.
Yeah.
But the point is, you want the individual peaks to not leak into each other.
Yep.
The height of the individual electron charges is the actual information, but the fact that they don't leak into each other.
So the actual image would, I mean, it's a millions of pixels, and then you have all the tracks and stuff, but you can count exactly how many electrons are on each pixel. Okay, so.
What's the distribution look like if it's in the dark, if you don't charge anything
out? So you want to know what's the dark count rate?
Yeah.
So the dark count rate, I will talk about that in a bit. But yeah, essentially, ideally, it would look like just a zero. Then if you have some dark counts, you will have another peak in one, and then another peak in two, depending on how high this dark count rate is.
I guess this depends on backgrounds and radioactivity.
Well, there are one source of dark counts that is coming from the thermal fluctuations in the detector. And defects in the crystal lattice, and that is where these sensors being parasitically produced is important, because we did not get to choose the quality of the silicon, so the silicon is not the best silicon that we can get, so the dark counts are higher in this thing. And also, these things have been thinned. That means that a lot of material has been removed from them in order to make them suitable for astronomical applications. And that also has a probability of introducing defects. So we expect, and we know that these detectors have a relatively high dark count rate when compared to others.
Maybe you're going to get to this, but what dark count rate per pixel do you think you can get to?
So I will discuss that in detail, yeah.
Well, while we're on this one, yeah. Jeff, the Carter scale goes to negative numbers of electrons. Does that actually mean anything?
No. So in this case, yes. Because, I mean, you have, if just by looking at the empty pixels, you will have some chance of measuring a negative voltage there because of the RMS of the Gaussian. So, yes. In this case, you don't have any because this thing is, I mean, you will have some amount there close to zero that will be negative, but that's what you expect from a Gaussian. Yeah.
I assume a lot of backgrounds are going to saturate pixels with electrons. Will you get to that? Which backgrounds can be discriminated on
yes.
the basis of
overcorrection. Yep. Okay, so now if we say, okay, let's see how far we can get with this technology. This is the, so we have shown some light in our detector, and you see that we can keep counting electrons, 49, 50, no problem. Because in principle, if these samples are non-correlated and independent, we should not pay any penalty for, I mean, the occupancy that we have in each pixel. And in here, what I'm showing is the single pixel distribution after exposing the CCD to an X-ray source. So this thing here has about 6 kV of energy. And now if we zoom in into this region, we can still keep counting individual electrons, so 1555, 1556. So for me, this is absolutely mind-blowing. I don't know of any other detector that can do something like this and this super long.
And they're still centered on quanta of charge. There's no charge through.
No.
In principle, as you go up in charge, now even if you have this.
At some point, yes.
At some point, it'll tail off.
Yes. So at some.
So far away from the.
Well, I mean, we don't know. The thing is that even at these occupancy levels. We haven't really found an application for this capability. So if you can think of something, let us know. I mean, at low energies, yeah, we have lots of applications. But at higher energies, it's not clear that this trick is useful. But that's still mind-blowing.
You should be seeing shot noise at this point, right? So the number should be something like plus minus the square root of the number. If you had a constant photon flux, then you would have shot noise, and it was shot noise limited, like some laser or something, then you would have shot noise fluctuations.
So you expect some, variability by the charge production itself that will make this peak wider than the resolution.
You integrate that to get the number of electrons.
Yeah.
Because you only really have real electrons, you don't have fractional electrons.
Yeah, exactly. So it will always produce a peak.
Just to be clear, so I understand what you're saying. I mean, whatever deposits electrons can be such that the truth level electron output will have short noise.
Yes.
Yeah. But the point is, this will still precisely tell you the truth level electron output.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is also technicality, but it was very important when we reached this level. So what I'm showing here is the X-ray spectrum if you take just the first sample that you read out, the second one, and the 20th one. So what you expect is that if these things are behaving properly, the gain and the position of the peak and the shape of this spectrum should all be the same. And we did get that. So this was very important because this was one of the biggest issues in previous implementations of these detectors, that you could not get a stable gain, and then that produced some extra smearing that would not allow you to get to these super low levels of noise. So in here, what I'm showing you is in the y-axis is the sigma of the empty pixels distribution as a function of the number of samples that you read out, okay? And also the time it takes to read out, okay? And what you have here, the red line is not a fit. We are just taking the value for the single sample distribution and then dividing that by 1 over the square root of n. And as you can see, all the measurements that we have follow this thing quite closely, and that is telling us that essentially there is nothing else to gain here. So we are already at the limit of the 1 over the square root of n. We only see a small deviation at thousands of samples, and still that I think we could get rid of if we.
So 4,000, how long does it take to read out the entire CCD?
It takes about an hour. So that's the price that you pay.
But if you wanted to optimize, right, you could just take fewer samples and just take it such that you could just tune the width of your gas to whatever you want.
Yeah, and you can do that dynamically. So in principle, for astronomical applications or imaging applications, you could think of a system that changes that depending on what it sees. Or if you have just one region that you want to map with super high precision and then other regions that you don't care so much about, you can do that, by software.
Maybe this is the wrong question, but what's the dead time?
So there is no dead time.
Right.
There is, so depending on what you mean by dead time. So when you are reading out the CCD is still being exposed. So for dark matter or neutrino applications in which you get a continuous flux of the particles that you are trying to detect, there is no dead time while you read out. Because...
I had a similar question. Is it correct to say that in that 3x3 toy grid that you showed, there were these 9 H registers that sort of saved the state of the chip?
Mm-hmm.
And that's fast.
Well, that is fast regarding the time it takes to read out the CCD. But it is very slow compared to the charge production and drift. So if you have an interaction in the silicon, it will go to the potential well and...
Sure. But what I mean is there's some time delta T that it takes to empty the CCD into the H registers.
Yes.
And then the CCD is empty and will be exposed.
Yep.
And then you take an hour to read out the H registers. That's the way that
Yes.
time is split.
I mean, that would be the way you operate this thing, for example, if you are doing imaging. So you expose your CCD with all your clocks frozen. And then you close your shutter, okay, and read out for 1 hour, let's say. But if you are doing a dark matter search, you won't do that because you don't have a shutter. So you will be reading out continuously, and while you read out, you get events, okay?
I guess the sort of primitive question is, as you're shifting things around, I guess with dark matter, you don't care at all about position accuracy. Like getting things swept up.
Exactly. So that is a problem. So you lose one coordinate when you are reading out. I mean, if you have an event that happens while you were reading out, you will not know one coordinate in the CCD. You will know the other, no problem, but not...
For dark matter, you don't care.
For dark matter, we mostly don't care. There are situations in which you might care, but...
And you don't expect a rate at which while you're popping this charge over another dark matter event happens and doubles the charge in that happy cell.
And the probability of that is the same as having one in one position and being hit by it. So that doesn't change.
So how do you get the readout? How do you get the muon track?
So the muon track essentially happens instantaneously. So when you have a muon going through the CCD, it produces ionization, it drifts, and that's an instant in CCD time.
So what the question is,
but I thought if you were reading out at
the moment,
it would be smeared across.
You lose the absolute coordinate value, but you don't lose the relative local coordinate. So you still have reconstruction perfectly. I mean, if you have something that has some structure, a track or whatever hitting your CCD, that shape you will keep.
Yeah, of course.
What you lose is the absolute coordinate. Mm-hmm. But, but I mean, as you have situations in which that coordinate is important. For example, if you are trying to do fiducialization or understanding backgrounds or understanding if there is a hot pixel or a hot area in your detector. But for doing that, you could expose your CCD for a time that it's much longer than the readout time, and then read out, and then you have perfect imaging with absolute XY coordinates capabilities. Okay. So now, what's the limitation of this thing? We are now counting electrons, noise has zero impact, but now it takes a long time to read out a sensor. So the dark counts are the limiting factor for the threshold that your detector has regarding rare event searches. If you are doing imaging, then this is not necessarily the case, but if you are doing rare event searches, this is your limiting factor. And to understand that, let's say that we have a benchmark experiment that has 100 grams of these detectors, okay? So many, about 50 of these detectors, let's say, and you are reading out these things continuously to minimize the exposure, because the shortest exposure for a pixel that you can have is the amount it takes you to read out, okay, to shift the charge from one end of the CCD to the other one. And you read this continuously for 1 year. Okay? So in here, what I'm showing is, depending on what the dark count rate is, I have three different benchmarks. This is the expected number of pixels that you will get with one electron, two electrons, or three electrons. Okay? And if you are doing a rare event search, you want this number to be essentially zero. Okay? So what you have is that the best measurement that we have for dark current on CCDs is coming from an upper bound that we measured with the DAMIC detector that is at SnowLab that uses conventional CCDs. And using those measurements, we got to a value that is roughly 10 to the minus 3 electrons per pixel per day. And the CCDs that we are fabricating, these Skipper CCDs, have essentially the same design, the same construction, the same provider, the same facility that fabricates them, and the silicon that we are using is even higher quality than the one that we use for DAMIC. Okay, so given that, this is an upper bound. We know that we are, in a way, guaranteed. Of course, when you are talking about experiments, you can always have things that are unexpected, but in principle, we are guaranteed this level. But if you do the theoretical calculation of what's the dark count rate that you would expect from the temperature of the sensors and the quality of the silicons that we have, you get a value that is 10 to the minus 7. So the real value for the dark count rate will be something between these two limits. So I have just put 10 to the minus 5 as a benchmark. And what you can see is that if the dark count rate is 10 to the minus 3, that is the upper bound that we have measured, what we get is that we cannot use two electrons for rare event searches, because we will have thousands of events over the duration of 1 year. But we can use three electrons, because we then expect zero events there. If the dark count rate turns out to be 10 to the minus 5, that is very reasonable. What we will be able to use the two electrons threshold. And what I'm showing here is that even with a dark count rate that is 10 to the minus 7, you cannot do much better than this for rare event searches. And the reason is that once you have one single electron there, then it's very hard to use that for a rare event search. I don't think that it's realistically possible to use this in a zero background experiment for a rare event search.
So this is two electrons per year.
Sorry?
This is two electrons per year.
This is two electrons in the same pixel. Yeah.
Per year.
Per year.
No, per year.
Yeah. After running 100 grams experiment for 1 year.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the expectation that you get from Poisson and the value that we have for the dark counts. Okay? Now I will use the two electrons as a benchmark for the threshold here. And if you do that, here is the predicted sensitivity. And what you have here is the cross-section of the interaction of the dark matter with the electrons as a function of the mass of the dark matter particle for two cases, one in which we have a light dark photon as the mediator, and another one in which we have a heavy dark photon as the mediator. And these blue regions are the existing limits from xenon. And what you see is that after running a 10-gram experiment for 3 hours, you already have the best limit here because of the smaller band gap of the silicon. And after running for a 100-gram experiment for 1 year, you are able to explore almost all of this region that is favored by observations. Okay, so
where would the LZ, once it's run for a year, be on this plot?
So you will notice that xenon 10 is actually better than xenon 100, and the reason for this is that
xenon 110 is even higher.
Well, we don't know. But the reason for this is that you actually care a lot about the single electron rate or two electron rate. And xenon 10 was actually cleaner than xenon 100 in that respect. So you had a smaller rate of electrons jumping out. So it doesn't scale with mass. So this is completely dominated by background. So this is not a zero background experiment. It's just we are going to place a limit. We take the rate, and we can do that. And it's not clear what will happen with LC. So there is a recent result from DarkSci, which is roughly similar to the one of xenon 10. So the mass in this game is not that important.
CDMS is off-scale high here?
Well, CDMS, right now, they are not even... So there is a... so, no, there are not in... I will go back to that in a minute. So there is a very recent result from CDMS in which they tested a 1 gram prototype detector. And the limit is it's worse than xenon 10, I think, by two orders of magnitude. But they explore a region here. And I will show you... I mean, we have also done that. I will talk about that.
I mean, the super CD, the upgraded super CDMS detectors, mm-hmm. once they get full exposure, will be able to probe above a G.
Yeah.
Down to whatever, minus 2.7 or something.
So, yeah, the technology for doing this, it's not proven yet. So they have, you have the main, please correct me if I say something wrong. I'm talking about what I know. So as far as I understand, so the Super CDMS main goal, the objective that it was laid when they designed the experiment and they went through the G2 process was to optimize the detector for nuclear recoils, for what I call standard WIMPs. Okay? So for that, they need to scale up in mass, and they need to have fairly large detectors, even though if the threshold is not the best. So that is what they are building at SnowLab. They have a program for lowering the threshold of these detectors that it's not yet proven. So there is a prototype sensor that they have recently developed in which they have some electron counting capabilities. That they did use during a surface run to produce a bound, but it's not clear. In principle, that is not the detectors that they are deploying at SnowLab.
I also need to correct my own statement. What I realized I was doing is I was mapping that vertical axis to dark photon mixing. And in that case, the upgrade detectors can do nuclear recoil measurements that are relevant in the GeV range, but you're not measuring the same thing. So in the pure CDE,
The scale here is MeV, so we go down to the MeV region.
Yeah. I mean, this on the gray region on the left part, for example, on the right side, that actually comes from assuming it's dark photon GeV, so it doesn't have a nuclei. So those are limits from nuclear recoil selections, from plants, getting them to the
Yeah,
this one, yeah.
So the recent result from the Super CDMS test project where they stuck, I think, a gram of germanium in a basement.
No, it says it's silicon.
Oh, it's silicon. Okay, thanks. Their test run got like a number of orders of magnitude below your test run, but that's just the result of them using a larger exposure.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I will.
Okay.
Yeah. Are these projections based on the one electron bin?
No, these are two electrons threshold.
Two, okay.
Yeah.
And how many electrons are deposited in a pixel if a minimum ionizing particle goes straight through the pixel?
Oh, thousands.
Thousands?
Okay. Yeah, so or at least hundreds, depending on what's the angle and stuff, but you deposit a lot. So yeah, that's not, identifying that, it's not a problem at all. The problem is the dark counts.
Could you put that where we're looking at it and like see awesome mono charged particles?
Yeah, we're thinking about something like that. Yeah.
Put it where
we're looking is it's like a fairly fairly conventional photo bunch of diodes or scintillators, but they're totally dot count dominated and it's
Yeah, we are thinking about how things that we can do with these things for miniature.
Oh, yeah. I think we're about to ask the exact same question. Can you give us a feeling for, like, if the if your MIP gives you 1,000, 10,000, and you literally are sensitive to one, and does that mean, do you have a feeling if you, did you ever compute, like, if I do have a little charge, how many do I get in my thickness? I mean, is the limiting factor how thick I can make my CCD? Is that sort of the problem?
So, yeah, I mean, one problem is the mass, so you have the interaction probability.
Yeah.
But in here, you have a super low threshold, so that also buys you something. Mm-hmm. So the detailed calculations are in progress. But yeah, it's people at Fermilab doing these things. Mm.
What's then the main thing you could confuse when you have your two-electron thing? Is it like a neutron or what's the main confusion there?
So I will talk about that in a minute also, because here I'm saying a zero-ish background experiment, and I will spend some time explaining what I mean with zero-ish background. But essentially, the dominating factors are, dark counts, and then the physical background is coming mostly from quantum events in the low-energy quantum spectrum, from high-energy gammas. Okay, so I move forward. So this is the reach for absorption. So in this case, we have MeV scale, okay? And here you have EV scale. So in this case, you have the situation in which the dark photon is completely absorbed in the silicon. So you deposit all the mass there. So this is the reach that we are able to get for dark photon model and for action light particles.
The cutoff is, I guess, 4 electron volts, and that's
3.7. This is probably conservative because we know that we can detect EV range. In this case, we are using the average energy that it takes to produce a pair of electron holes, but that is not the actual threshold. But this region.
Well, this is what discovery potential, because you don't expect background there, right? Mm-hmm. You could just measure the 1 electron beam.
So
then we actually go lower. So you might actually beat the setup constraints even on that.
Even with the huge fall off, because they're falling out first.
Right.
What are the weird jagged drops at like a KeV?
Yeah,
silicon bands.
That must be still like an X-ray.
Okay.
It's about structural.
Maybe it's like
KeV? Or you've got the shells.
Have a 1.7 KeV shell.
Okay. So it's not the band structure,
That's the bounding energy of the electrons.
Yeah.
The bounding energy of the inner electrons in the atom. Okay, so now what do I mean with a zero-ish background experiment? So let's take this case as benchmark. So this is the light mediator, electron scattering. And what you have here is that, for example, for a mass of 10 MeV, this is the rate of events that you expect as a function of the number of electrons that you ionize, okay, that you produce in the interaction. And what you can see is that after 2, between 2 and 3 and so on, roughly you expect one order of magnitude less events per beam that you move forward. So essentially, you are completely dominated by the lowest energy / charge beam that you are being able to see, and you have a counting experiment in one beam. So that is what we essentially have here. And if you use that as a benchmark, and again going back to the 100 grams running for 1 year, you have this exposure, and then we assume that the same background level that we see in DAMIC, that it's an experiment currently running at SnowLab, that has 5 DRU. For the people that it's not working on dark matter, DRU means events per kilogram per day per KV. It's differential rate unit. Okay. But so this is the level of counts that we see in DAMIC, which is not even the leading experiment here. Okay. So for example, you have an idea, super CDMS at SnowLab, it's aiming for 2 orders of magnitude reductions over this value. So That is very hard, but we are not aiming for that. And so we are just assuming that we are just able to reproduce what we have already done in another experiment. Okay? And in DAMIC, what we have is that we have this thing dominated by quantum gammas, okay, high energy gammas. And let's say that we look at the 0 to 1 keV range, okay, and then we divide that range by the average energy that it takes to make an electron hole pair. So you have 278 energy slash charge bins in that region. And then you compute from the back of the envelope calculation how many events you expect in a given bin. And in this case, that gives you that from 5 DRU and a completely flat X spectrum, you expect 0.65 events in that thing. So this was very rough, because we know that the Compton spectrum is actually not flat at lower energies. But this gives you the idea that what we mean with a zero-ish background experiment. Now, if we look at this in more detail to see if our back of the envelope calculation is actually conservative or it's too optimistic, in here, what I'm showing is the Compton spectrum that you expect up to 200 keV. So this is a much broader range. And what we know is that in DAMIC, we are able to get to 5 DRU in this low energy region. Okay, so that will be our normalization level. Now, if we zoom in here, this is the theoretical calculation by just correcting the Klein-Ishina spectrum and by the amount of electrons that are available given the binding energies of silicon. And then you have these steps that are produced by electrons that you are not accessible anymore. Okay? So this is the 5 DRU level. And what you can see in a log scale is that at the lowest energies, that is where we are really interested in looking, this buys us a lot. So the background reduction is huge. The detail level of these things will depend, I mean, depends on the band structure. And for this calculation, I just did the, atom in vacuum thing. So this part here is not completely reliable, but in any case, it will be smaller than this level. So if we take this, we are already one third of the background that we had in the back of the envelope calculation. So that is good. Now, this was just a theoretical calculation. Now, if we go and look at some detector effects that you can have, so you might have an event that is happening close to the surface of your CCD. So you have a partial energy deposition event in which the electron leaves your detector and only produces a small amount of ionization. And this will populate your low energy region. So this is actually a bad thing. So to actually understand what was the effect of these things, we ran a detailed GN4 simulation in which we have our detectors, thin detectors with a proper geometry. And what you have is this thing. For this thing, we are using the GN4 3D Monash model that is the best low energy Compton model that is available currently. And what you have is that in this energy region, we normalize that to 5 DRU level, and we are perfectly fine. So, yep.
So this one takes into account this surface effect, but not the detailed band structure, right?
No, this takes into account the detailed band structure.
Oh, and the surface.
Yeah, and also assuming atoms in vacuum, so not the crystal lattice. So this part here, but still.
Not the band structure.
Not the band structure, but the binding energies.
So this blue curve is the Monte Carlo result. So why does it drop?
So these steps is the same as in the Klein-Ishina situation. You have less electrons available for recoil. Because the binding energy, if you transfer, less than the binding energy, you don't actually, you cannot have that interaction.
What are all the specific steps?
All these steps are coming from the orbital levels, the shell structure of the silicon. So that's the way I computed this.
It's worth commenting, I guess, about 50 volts or so, the atom is a very good model for the solid.
Yeah.
So you can go to the Berkeley website and download the tables from, what's his name? There's an X-ray website.
Hagman.
And they'll calculate the refractive index of silicon with the extinction coefficient. Yeah. It's pretty good.
Yeah. So
below 50 volts,
Yeah, below 50 volt, it's not good because you have actually to
take. Yeah. We have a student that worked in detail for band structure updates.
Why was that plot good though? You had like 200 events in that other plot.
Sorry, which one?
Next one. So you have like 400. Why is that good? 400 events?
Oh, no. So, I mean, this is just not normalized. This the normalization level is the 5 DRU. So this is 5 DRU, so that needs to be compared with the 0.65 expected events per bin if it was flat all the way down, but it's not. So this needs to be rescaled at least by this, dividing this by this level, at least. Does it make sense?
It's saying it's actually half of what you expect, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah, so 0.65 events per bin, where this would be where the 5 DRU level is, the red line. It's, you know, these are the factor of 2 lower. So it's going to be 0.3-ish events per bin.
0.3 events.
Yeah.
Or even lower.
In the lowest energy bin.
Yeah.
So if you look at this thing, so our detector is quantized because we only see 1, 2, 3 electrons. I mean, we don't. So if you divide the 0 to 1 kV range into bins of charge, using the amount of charge that it takes to generate one electron, so you get 278 bins.
So in 1 year, you'll see 0.3 electrons in your 2-electron bin.
Yeah.
And that's like a 1 sigma, right?
Yeah, so that's what I mean with zero-ish. So it's the expectation value. I mean, the true value of that will actually be given by this here. So it can be actually much, much smaller than what I'm showing in here. It's just that we don't have the confidence in the simulation to. So if you look at the lowest energy bin, is that. So that is five times lower than that.
So you see that two events in your 2-electron bins in a year, how are you going to know it's not that?
So if, yeah, so this is, we have an expectation for the background that is 0.3. So if we see one, that is not 90% confidence level for discovery. If we see 5, then yes. Okay, so let's move forward. Need to move faster. So what's going on now? We have our prototype sensor installed at the Minos underground site at Fermilab, which is 100 meters underground. And it's sitting on the same place, I mean, just across the hall of the NOVA detectors. We are in the neutrino beam, but we don't actually care about the neutrinos in this case. And so we have our detector that is running underground that we are using for understanding the technology and trying to see if we can place a competitive limit, even given the high dark current that these parasitically produced detectors have. And then another thing that was very exciting is that before taking this thing underground, we had a commissioning run at the surface just to check that the detector was working. So we didn't expect to use this data for any physics, but actually we realized that we can. So we took 6 hours of data, and not the best quality data because this was just, we turned on the detector, we measured things, we took this underground. This is the spectrum of what we measured there. So in this case, we only took 800 samples, and I'm showing you the log plot. So these are the bumps. The peaks are not as thin as the ones that I showed you before, because in this case we only took 800 samples instead of 4,000. Okay, but you can clearly differentiate between 1, 2, 3, and 4 electrons in the pixels. Okay, so this was a tiny, tiny exposure of 0.02 gram days, and we had a relatively high dark current of about 1 electron per pixel per day. This was mostly coming from the fact that we just turned on the detector, we didn't do any of the procedures that we do for reducing the dark counts. If we operate the same system underground and we take care of those things, we get an order of magnitude better, which is still high, compared to other things, but we knew that because the quality of the silicon in these sensors. But in any case, we don't have any events above 5 here, and we only have a single event with 4 electrons. So we can use that to place a very interesting limit for the actually high cross-section region. Because one thing that is usually overlooked is that these detectors that we are building are underground. So if the dark matter actually has a relatively high cross-section, it will not actually get to our detectors. And these regions here are actually not excluded. So it would be incredibly funny if we actually are not seeing dark matter because we are going too deep. So we did this surface run, and we are able to exclude about 3 orders of magnitude of parameter space. You have to compare this line here, that is the Earth scattering limit that you had for the xenon 10 experiment, to this line here. In the assumptions in these two cases are the same. And then if you assume that the dark matter only interacts with electrons but doesn't interact with protons, you get this other line here. But yeah, so this is very exciting. We are already being able to explore the high cross-section region. We have the best limit there. And also, at the time, we had the best limit at the lowest energy region, that is below 500 keV. After this result was public, the CDMS collaboration produced their result with a small prototype sensor, and they have a limit that is stronger on the for this side, but not for this side. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. Can you say a little bit more about the how well understood is the expected spectrum of 1, 2, and 3, 4 electrons from the dark matter CDMS?
So for that, we are using a simplified model in which we use just the average energy that it takes to produce an electron hole pair. And that is actually very conservative, because we know that splitting can happen at even smaller energies. So that needs to be measured experimentally, actually, because the assumption that we are using right now, I think it's very conservative. But if we really want to push this to the limit, we really need to measure that experimentally. And we can do that. We just need to produce photons with few eV energies and do the measurements with those and see what's the distribution of single, 2 electrons, 3 electrons. And we have a program for doing that, but it will take some time.
What we spend a lot of time doing is harvesting the electron recoil spectrum and electron recoil energy.
But how that translates to 1, 2, 3, that's the thing that has to be measured. That's one problem. Okay, so this is the timeline. We had our LDRD fully funding. Now by the end of this year, we expect to have a 10-gram experiment running in Minas. And then by the end of next year, we expect to have a 100-gram experiment running in a deeper underground site. That could be Surf or Snow Lab at this point. And yeah, so this is the timeline. We are fully funded and we are moving forward full steam. So yeah, I'm finished here. I spent too much time.
What's the total cost?
So it's a tricky question in the So we have about 1 million cost of materials. Then labor, it's roughly, I'm being recorded, so I cannot say. But yeah, it's comparable, let's say.
How many pixels will the 100 grams detector have?
Lots.
You're making it thicker, I guess. Is that how you get
Yeah, so we are making them thicker, but about a factor of 2, 3 thicker. And the pixel size is the same. And you have more detectors, so you have about 100 million pixels. But that's order. Yeah. I can tell you the exact number. Yeah.
Okay.
after this. I always forget.
Other questions?
The prototype sensor that SuperCDMS uses is it essentially the same technology? Or is it something?
No, it's completely different. So in the case of the SuperCDMS detector, what they are looking at is ionization also, but through the phonons they produce after they accelerate the ionization produced. So they are just being able to see ionization when they operate these prototype sensors. But the way to detect that ionization is by accelerating the electron hole pairs and making them collide with the crystal lattice, and then measure the phonons that are produced by this.
Skipper CCDs, are they called skipper because you're skipping the electrons back and forth?
Yeah, actually it's a really bad name, I think, but you could say, I mean, the origin of the name, it was because in principle you could skip some pixels that are not interesting and then measure some of the other ones with a very high number of samples. But, I don't know, with a standard CCD you can also skip pixels if you want. So it's...
You showed a plot for bounds on photon, dark photon, dark matter. If the dark photon is the dark matter, and you measure by absorption. So you have dark photon at whatever 10 eV or something, and you absorb it. Now, this might sound a little silly, but if you had a hidden sector that was interesting enough to have its own sources of massless dark photons. Then it's probably an easy calculation, but could you use this, could you bury it in the ground and make it a dark photon telescope, essentially?
Yes. Yeah.
Is there some feeling for...
It's not clear.
...dark photon chance of absorption as compared to epsilon?
I guess it's the same as the
lipstick. Sorry, it's a massive dark photon in your diagonal and... Rotate the only it's massless and there's no charge under it. There's nothing, it's decoupled.
Yeah.
So it's either massive or you see the moon.
But just to try to think about what you're saying, are you thinking of using it as a telescope or heliostat?
Of some, I mean.
It's set from the sun, I think.
You can look for miniature particles.
Yeah.
So you said the one last piece of device design you skipped over, the actual barrier that you now are raising and lowering. So you're basically going from something that was doping to a gate. Is that what's actually allowing you to skipper? How are you actually raising and lowering the barrier to...
So there are... Let me see if I have... Oh, no, I don't have it. Sorry. I don't have a plot for that. But. There are many changes that we've done over the years on this thing. I honestly cannot identify a single kind of silver bullet that was the thing that changed everything. That old output gate that we have. So yeah, the output gate. In the skipper sensors, it's a clock, the same as the others, so you are able to move it down and up. And then what changed a lot is this part, the sense node. The sense node, it's what it's called a floating gate now. So you have this extra capacitor connected, so you have a extremely good isolation between the sense node and the transistor that is the output. And that has changed. Also, all the way that these things are fabricated and how you get isolation from the readout stage, from the outside fields, that has improved a lot. The quality of the silicon has improved a lot.
I did miss one thing. When you're all done, you skipped it back and forth, got your number, you've got to drain this charge.
Oh, yeah. Right? We still have this thing here that we can connect and drain, okay. Yes.
Thank you.